Everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Cradle News Roundup coming to you live. My name is Esteban Carrillo, back from a brief break I'm the news editor for the Cradle. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and writer for the Cradle, who was also on a brief break, Karim Shami, and the columnist and editor for the Cradle, Sharmeen Narwani. And before we start, we just want to remind you, as soon as you arrive to this stream, please hit the like button. Become a member or become a subscriber and share this transmission. Also, make sure to check out our memberships, but most importantly, check out our Patreon, where you can become a direct supporter of the Cradle and help us continue to do the work that we do here. And since I'm taking a bit of a shilling break to shill some products, let me just mention very briefly the new book by one of our writers, William Van Wagenen, Creative Chaos. Make sure to get it. This is Inside the CIA's Covert War to Topple the Syrian Government. You can get it at your favorite bookshop or online store. Make sure to get it. Very interesting. William, who has also been featured here in the podcast several times and writes regularly for us. Very, very interesting read. He unravels many of the things that we often discuss here in the podcast. So make sure to get it. Just one more time, Creative Chaos. It's available now. Guys,
just to mention something on that, because I met William because of the Syrian war. I was really known at the time mainly for my Syrian war coverage from the ground. And William contacted me one day and we started communicating. He'd been using some of my articles, my investigative work, for his long read articles. And I found William just one of those unusual journalists. Who just knew how to do deep dives, knew how to find information that was so hard for others, English-speaking reporters. You know, he just sort of like went to the crux of things. And I was very enamored with his work. And I have read some of his long reads on Syria. They are unmissable. They literally bring together all the threads of all the different kind of reporting happening on Syria. And I can't wait to read his book, because I'm sure it is going to be the book on the conflict.
I'm also, yes. And I second that completely. William is one of the best researchers I have ever met. So make sure you get, here it is, his book. Make sure to get it. Very, very fascinating topic that which he knows a lot about. With that out of the way, let's begin discussing, as usual, we're never at a lack of topics. But yesterday, something very, very interesting happened in Gaza, in the city of Khan Yunis. And it's a Palestinian resistance ambush that took Israeli troops by surprise and ended with the wounding of several of them and an attempt at a kidnapping. The Palestinian troops literally came out of tunnels that the Israeli army didn't even know about to launch this raid. About 18 Palestinian fighters with rifles, with RPGs, grenade launchers, lay siege to this base. Why am I saying, well, first of all, we're nearly 2 years into this genocide, right? Into this complete Holocaust that has been unfolding in Gaza. And we're talking about the city of Khan Yunis, which, and I don't know if you guys remember exactly the number, but has been declared cleared of Hamas fighters multiple times. Has been, the Israeli army has claimed to be in control of Khan Yunis multiple times since the start of the genocide, including mapping the tunnel systems underneath. And yet they get ambushed, they get caught with their pants around their ankles. And this comes as the Israeli military is preparing to call up 60,000 reservist forces for a total of 130,000 troops that are going to be mobilized to take control of Gaza City, which they know is going to be a very tough task to do because, of course, they're talking about several Hamas battalions, well, Qassam Brigade's battalions, still remain within Gaza City. And this event yesterday in Khan Yunis kind of shows that the Israeli army seems to not at all be prepared for what's coming to them, or more likely what's waiting for them in Gaza City. And it fits into into the narrative we have seen, or I don't know the narrative, more like the reality, that you cannot defeat a native resistance force by blunt force alone, especially when you're talking about their territory, and especially when you're talking about Gaza, which has one of the largest subterranean tunnel systems in the world constructed by the resistance, and which Hamas has been able to, throughout the past 2 years, continuously reconstitute and refill their ranks despite the genocide. So with all of that in mind, What awaits the Israeli army in Gaza City?
Can you?
Yes. Kala, what happened 2 days ago was also shocking for the Israeli media. We saw many reports saying and claiming, you know, after all these months, and this is happening, if the Israeli troops went there, and we know that the army is talking about 60,000 troops is going there, so the casualties of the Israeli army will be higher. And also Hamas, or media affiliated to Hamas, said that they acquired explosive during the war. We know many explosives from Israel and U.S. weapons that didn't explode in Gaza, and many Israelis are afraid that these weapons will be used during the invasion. And also the Israeli media commenting on this video, they said that the Hamas fighters, they were fully equipped and they had all their uniforms on, which indicates that they might be willing to take some soldiers or to kidnap some soldiers from the field, because usually we see them. Usually they are like wearing casually during their fighting against the Israelis, but this time they were fully prepared and it was like a big operation. Till now we don't know, because everything that's happening is coming out from the Israeli media. We don't know the scale of the success of the operation, but the Israeli media showed some videos and some photos that they managed to kill some of the fighters. But such operations will be a very big blow up for the Israelis, Netanyahu, and the people behind them. Don't you think so, Sharmeen?
We can't hear Sharmeen. I can't hear you. I don't know if you muted.
Wait.
There you are. Okay. There you are.
Yeah. Okay. So the way the Israeli media made it out, first of all, you know, we always get these alerts that there's an incident. There's an important incident. Yeah. And that means that there's probably going to be Israeli troops helivacked over to hospitals. You know, all hospitals are then on alert for incoming injured or dead. In this case, I mean, the Israelis really seem to react very strongly to this. Again, as y'all were saying, they didn't expect this kind of organization and reaction in Khan Yunis, of all places. And then, of course, the Israelis like to always spin the story to their advantage. They talked about this unique event that happened that was unanticipated and very organized. And as you mentioned, these the fighters, the Palestinian resistance, were all in uniforms, and you know, it was an ambush and a besiegement of the Israeli base, and yet the Israelis claim that they killed these guys, not mentioning any injuries or deaths on their own side or losses of any kind. So I think they wouldn't have characterized the incident as something abnormal and surprising, a shock really, if it hadn't had an impact on the forces. And I don't just mean morale, but I mean in dead and injured. So As usual, we're going to have to wait a long time for that information to trickle out. But if, in fact, it was they took some hits, some serious hits, and unanticipated and unplanned for ones, then, of course, the Israeli chief of staff, Eyal Zamir, who, you know, butted heads with Netanyahu with the cabinet meeting discussing the reoccupation of Gaza, saying it's not possible, and now has obviously acceded to Netanyahu's demands and greenlit it, you know, and talks about it, you know, and has announced it himself, saying by land, air, and sea, we're going to do this. He will be proven right, you know, literally at the first hurdle, right? Mm-hmm. As the gates open for this hell that Israel's about to unleash on Gaza, a surprise, organized, obviously planned out ambush of Israeli troops where they least expected it, where they thought they'd mapped out the tunnel infrastructure, et cetera, from a tunnel they knew nothing about. So what other surprises lay ahead of them? I mean, really, like for the Palestinian resistance to win this round would simply mean doing a few of these things that take the army off guard, you know, throw them off guard and just cripple morale, because then they don't know what's coming. You just need a few. It's kind of like the old Israeli whisper campaigns, like, oh, you know, attacks are coming to your Palestinian village. You should flee. This kind of thing can hit morale so badly, because, you know, the Israelis don't go into Gaza or any theater of conflict without air cover, without ambulances behind them and tanks in front of them, right? And drones surrounding them. So this kind of thing where soldiers are just caught, as you said, with their pants around their ankles is a severe shock. It's very much reminiscent of what happened on October 7th, when in fact we saw visuals of various Israeli soldiers with pants around their ankles, or no pants at all for that matter.
Indeed. And you know, this comes at a time, it also reminded me what you're talking about right now, Sharmeen, is that I was just reading this report a couple of days ago about the settlers from Kiryat Shimona near the Lebanese border. More than half of them still haven't returned. And many of them have simply said, we are never going to return there. So there's this current, right, throughout Israeli society and the Israeli military of we are not achieving any of the goals. We are killing a lot of people, but we are not actually achieving the goals. We're not saving the captives. You saw like the marches earlier this week in Tel Aviv. It was like there were some people were saying there were 250K on the streets marching for the release of the captives, not so much for an end to the carnage. But, you know, it's kind of like a repeat. It keeps repeating. We're in this cycle of just repetition because we have seen this before. We have seen the ambushes before. We have heard about Hamas reconstituting its forces. We have seen the Israeli army come in and, you know, do its damage, etc. But at the same time, you are seeing the growing PTSD, a growing number of suicides, growing number of refusals to serve, of reservists refusing to join to re-enter Gaza. And also you have the Haredim, who, like I just saw before we connected, I saw this headline on Times of Israel, which says something like a condemnation after rabbi dances with a draft dodger on the street or something like that, you know, celebrating that they're dodging the draft. So yeah, it really does feel like this is becoming a war of one person, right? And that is Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now talking about greater Israel. He's talking with much more confidence about this idea of greater Israel, at the same time as he's having talks with Syrian officials, at the same time as you have Lebanon being, you know, really like with two guns on its head, being told to, you got to disarm Hezbollah, and you have, you know, Nawaf Salam. Did you see Nawaf Salam saying, if Israel attacks us after we implement the plan to disarm Hezbollah, they're going to face great consequences. I'm sure of that, Nawaf Salam. I'm very sure of that.
Yeah, that's exactly what we've been talking about here and for years, that when Israel finishes from a place, it will go to other places. And Netanyahu was so clear, yani. He indirectly threatened Egypt because they want to expand. Now, Gaza is weakened, Hezbollah is weakened. Now they want to expand. They want to expand to Syria, to Egypt, to Jordan, maybe later to Saudi Arabia. Although these countries did all what they can, and they put all their resources and their political power to protect Israel and to cover its genocide. It's so crazy. Still, they don't see it. Or because they are there to fulfill the vision of Israel. There's no other reason. Either they are super stupid or they are there to fulfill the vision of Israel.
I don't see Netanyahu as being confident. You know, I've always said that his job is to create a lot of noise, create a sense of making impact, of keeping momentum and growing momentum. That's a lot of narrative work rather than anything else. And of course, dropping bombs seems to, you know, put the exclamation point on a narrative when in fact it doesn't. You can kill people, but you can't achieve the political outcome that you've sought. I mean, we're talking like Vietnam onwards, right? Like they can drop bombs, but it doesn't actually mean they win the ground. And so I don't believe this is confidence on behalf of Netanyahu. This is simply his job to be kinetic, to talk kinetically, He can talk about, you know, he's sitting and he knows his adversaries well. And I don't mean the resistance adversaries. I mean the Arab regimes, right? He knows that if he says something out of the box and very hostile, they will just absolutely flutter around and just meet each other and call up the White House and call up London and, you know, but achieve nothing, and it will put them in a state of panic. He knows they can't actually do anything. He does not, as we've mentioned, have the troops to even execute on his Gaza occupation plan. This is something that will rely on, you know, his air force and aerial bombardment more than troops on the ground. Troops on the ground, it's, you know, it's easy for the resistance to snipe them off, and he can't afford any losses when Israel is at sort of a breaking point in terms of these mass demonstrations now against the war. It's the first time we've seen during the almost 2 years protests of this size. His cabinet is making no bones about the fact that they don't care about the hostages anymore. You have Israeli politicians and influential Israelis left, right, and center saying, you know, that who cares about the, well, not in those words, but basically the hostages will have to be sacrificed for our goals. But these are not attainable goals. You know, it's not like Israel occupied Gaza before and kind of had to leave in 2005 because it was, you know, it was unsustainable. I don't feel it's confidence. I just feel it's what he does in his job every single day. You know, be bullshy, make a lot of movements, declare crazy things, create a sense of momentum and energy and activity. Whereas in fact, if, you know, he was talking this way also, Esteban, at the beginning of the war, but 2 years on, I mean, do we take him seriously when he says,
look at Syria. Look at what the talks they're having with Syria about. They're talking now about creating some humanitarian corridor to Suweida.
In Syria, you could have an Israeli-Kurdish alliance, a Druze-Israeli alliance, even an Alawi-Israeli alliance. And actually, that doesn't make... Syria will be as weak and as contested as it was the day that the government of Bashar al-Assad fell. Syria is weaker than it's ever been. We know that, again, it's they make a lot, right? They have meetings. They make a lot of statements. They create the sense of, you know, absolute action. If Israel basically took over Syria tomorrow, it doesn't mean it could keep it. You know, in Syria, we're waiting for other sides to act, sides that have not been apparent or even in existence since December 2024. Syria's the competition over Syria is in its most nascent stages. And of course, strong actors or loud actors are going to be the soundings we hear at the stage. I just don't think any of these things are sustainable. They can't, you know, they're fighting in Gaza, they're fighting in the West Bank. Their settlers haven't moved back into northern Israel, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to take over vast swathes of Syria. That's not going to happen. It's just, they can, but they'll be pushed back.
And yeah, you're going to have an army that is just extended way past the breaking point. I always remember some 100%. Israeli official, when the war started, he would talk about the Israeli army is it's meant for like a shock offensive. You know, for like a short-term offensive, like this is how they're trained, this is how they operate, this is what they're meant to be. They're not meant to lay down like months-long siege. They're not prepared to do any of these things that they have been doing. And you're starting to see the, this is starting to become to their detriment, right? Like they are no longer being able to control it as much. But this all comes, you know, you, Shermin, always in particular, you say, you know, like we saw the picture earlier this week, right? The meeting of the European leaders with Zelensky in the White House. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you guys discussed it in the previous podcast. What an absurd moment in history. We see that Donald Trump is at this point kind of, you know, showing them the way out, in particular Zelensky. It seems like this man is really on his way out. And you always have said that, you know, maybe Netanyahu is going to fall into that bag soon. But he just, a couple of days ago, he called him a war hero. He said Netanyahu is a war hero, and then he called himself a war hero. So it really does feel, you know, like at this point, the United States is all in. Like, these guys are all in.
You know, they're all in until they're not. I mean, Trump is all in until he's not. Hang on that thought, because first of all, his Ukraine solution, even if the Europeans roll over and accept whatever deal Putin and Trump agree on, meaning exchange of land and some kind of extended ceasefire and troops, though the Russians have said they will not accept European troops in Ukraine. We'll see. But that's not going to happen overnight, and Trump will lose patience and want to, like, you know, zip through that. At the same time, it's not just the way he's talking about Israel. He just slapped sanctions on ICC or ICJ judges.
ICC.
Yeah, and, you know, he's showing a lot of support for Israel in many ways. But in this instance, Trump kind of stands alone, because the heat is rising so much on European leaders to do something maximalist against Israel. I mean, obviously the least of all is not sell weapons, right? But they always have ways to circumvent that. So they don't actually sell them their weapons, but they get stashes from, like, other periods and other arenas, and they, right, they siphon it off to them. So they might have, like, a warehouse in Serbia, and then it's moved to, right? Besides that, the pressure on the Europeans is so intense that really in the end, I think what we're going to see, especially if Netanyahu goes into Gaza as he's threatening, we're going to see the U.S. and Israel stand alone. And Trump doesn't like the bad press. I'm not saying it's happening now. I'm saying it's going to happen. It's just, it's not just from a place of hope. Do you not see how
I think you're correct,
isolated no. they've gotten? You know, this is something I was saying long ago. The longer the war goes on, the more the curtains drop. Right. The more you see the puppeteers behind the scenes, the more you see through the lies and the, you know, the misrepresentations and misinformation and disinformation and the horrors of what's going on there. As we said at the beginning, like, how long will people get tired of seeing the atrocities? You know, will they get immune to it? No, people are more horrified now than even back then, because they have seen a new kind of truth right now. So I said, the longer, the more protracted these battles are, these illegal wars, these genocidal wars, you know, these violent Western assaults on humanity and brown people especially,
yeah.
The more people wake up to the truth. And so, of course, it becomes more untenable for power to execute it's wars.
I want to touch on two topics on exactly what you're saying, but first let me just read it's not a donation, what do you call it? from Shannon L.
A super chat
from Shannon L, who says, one of my favorite channels, Charmin's analysis is very insightful to me. Mucho amor from America, aka the Imperial Corps. Thank you so much, Shannon. To your point, Charmin, yes, they are isolated. And you know what? You know, one of the better examples of this in the past few days has been the case of, is his name Tom Alexandrovich, the Israeli cybersecurity official, who gets arrested in a sex, in a child sex ring by the FBI for soliciting sexual favors from a minor, and is promptly let go by the Nevada Attorney General's office. His passport is not confiscated, and he just, you know, boards his flight to Israel and leaves. And now MAGA is freaking out about this. They're up in arms, because remember, this comes right on the heels of the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, of the whole, you know, Jeffrey Epstein never existed, according to Donald Trump and his FBI director. And so the MAGA fracturing keeps happening over Israel. Like, Israel keeps popping his head in this whole, you know, debacle that is the second presidency of Donald Trump, and what is going to happen to MAGA. Now you have, you know, these very prominent figures, like, for example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is the first member of Congress who comes out and calls what's happening in Gaza a genocide, and has also said, like, how is it possible that a person who gets arrested by the FBI in a child sex ring sting gets let go? Gets allowed to pay bail and leave. And these things, I mean, they're going to continue to happen. There's no end to this, right? Because in the Israeli entity, in the Zionist entity, I remember when there was the scandal about the troops posting like about 1 million posts per day from Gaza, and the of their atrocities, and the order they got was stop making posts on social media. It wasn't stop committing these atrocities, just stop posting on social media, stop making it so public, right? And I saw someone comment right now who said like Trump is very realistic when it comes to publicity. And I think that's very true. And it comes to your point, Charmin, of them being isolated. I want to hear from Karim. What do you think about this MAGA situation, Karim? Do you think there's any way to salvage MAGA and, you know, for them to reconnect with Trump, given the amount of support he's blindly given to Israel?
I think many people that supported Trump at the beginning and people that I think they, with their aid and support, he was elected. Many of them now turn over him, especially like Joe Rogan and other podcasters and social media influencers. And they turned on him because of Palestine, what's happening on Palestine, because he said that he will stop the war, and they believed him. And he did the opposite. He even bombed Iran.
He did, what I was going to say.
Yeah, nobody did it before him. So many people are against him now. I don't remember their names, but they are really, they are not few. And what's happening is crazy now. Everybody knows that the United States is controlled by AIPAC. And previously, we used to say, we here in the Middle East, sorry, in West Asia and other places, we knew that AIPAC controls United States after like 20 years. Now the Americans know that. And there's always a positive side
of things.
Yeah, they are a bit slow to catch up. And I think it's...
Go ahead.
Okay. So that's one. And the other one, eventually, I think if Trump and Netanyahu will clash, as Charmin suggests, is because Trump doesn't like to be controlled or to let anybody tell him as if he's a puppet. He wants always to be in control. And now it's very obvious in the media who's in control. It's AIPAC and Netanyahu. And of course, we know that the Epstein file is still very hot. And the comments that Trump did was very negative because he said, oh, he's talking about Epstein. And he's
cares?
The one.
Who cares anymore?
Yeah, and he's the one who started it before he was elected. He said, I will release everything. And the head of the FBI that he elected, he said, I will release the papers. So they did it. They let it like flow again. And they didn't release it. And now we're seeing as if it's like a mini Epstein. It's not as huge as it is. But you see, maybe the same religion, the same
nationality.
The same country is involved. The same nationality is involved. So... I don't know. And many people is saying, last time I watched a podcast also, they were talking the connection between Epstein and what happened 2 days ago, and even Diddy. They said that FBI came over to take all these files. They don't want anybody to release any video or any photo or any statement against this because apparently everything is connected.
And this guy, I mean, he's not just an Israeli, right? He's
official.
He's a military, right? The head of their cyber military operations. And he comes to the U.S., to Nevada, Las Vegas, and uses the internet, okay, to lure in young underage American girls. It's as bad as it could get. He's not just an Israeli. He literally is the guy who's plugged in, you know, the technologically superior Israel into the global internet. And of course, all those stuff, you know, about the sex trafficking Israelis and like, was it Colombia that were caught? Or it's all mashing together.
It was in Mexico. I remember that they were a Jewish cult was like expelled from a town. And my God, like the list is long. I just want to mention.
I want to mention something also. This is happening in the United States. What are they doing? Are they doing in poorer countries? It's crazy.
Indeed. Very well put, Karim. I want to thank Gulnara Marchis. Good old Gulnara. Thank you so much for your super chat. I wanted to mention something that people are saying here in the chat. And yes, that the district attorney who let this man go, Alexandrovich, go, is Israeli born. I mean, you know, we're not making any of this up. We're just simply pointing out the facts here. It's an unfortunate situation.
That's, I mean, it's just getting worse and worse and worse for Israel. Like, this is what I'm saying. Like, at some point, of course, you can't support Netanyahu. And of course, we are hearing, who was it? I always forget, because there are all these like white guys in Europe or women. They're all sort of, you know, just generic. None of them seems to have a platform. It's just neoliberal rubbish. So another European leader just, in this week said, you know, Netanyahu's the problem.
Was it Albanese, the guy from Australia?
Because no, going back and forth. No. I think it was a woman European leader. I'm sorry. They just sort of merge into each other for me. But I mean, to hear this, and it's going to get worse, because, you know, this is the thing about protracted conflict. This is what happened in Syria. If it had been like an Arab Spring kind of incident where mass protests and like Western media headlines, and then suddenly the dictator leaves, right? It would have been easy peasy. But because it was 8-9 years, right, of war, of course you're going to find out things. Of course the what's it called, the veil is going to drop. Of course there's going to be errors, and we're going to catch them. And there were so many, you know, they were tripping over each other, meaning the Israelis, the Turks, the Qataris, the Saudis, Emiratis, Americans, British, French. All these guys were just, you know, there were just major what's it called, like faux pas that became really obvious. I mean, I remember once interviewing the spokesman for CENTCOM in Tampa, and I was like, what do you have to say about the fact that those, I don't know, 10 troops that you spent $200 million training in Jordan just went over the border into Syria, and those same weapons were found in the hands of al-Nusra, you know, al-Qaeda. And he said, ma'am, we don't, we only train and whatever them. We don't command and control them. And it was, that's your answer. That's the U.S. You know, so there were just so many holes. The longer stuff goes on, the worse it is for these warmongers. And this is what I'm saying. There's no way out of this. Of course, Netanyahu is going to collapse under the weight of this. Of course, Trump is going to come into a direct confrontation with him. You know, they're making it easy to predict. It's not, of course, I'm not saying it's going to happen now, but like, open your imaginations. How can this be good? Trump being isolated on this, he wasn't isolated on Ukraine. You know, he could pull out a few cards on Ukraine. And Ukraine wasn't changing the world the way Gaza has. You know, Gaza's pitted north and south, you know, against each other entirely, and made such a sham out of everything the West has told us for decades about freedom and democracy and human rights, especially, and blows a hole through all their stupid laws that claim that they won't sell weapons to any country violating human rights. And so this kind of thing is it's world shifting as opposed to Ukraine.
Indeed. I want to, since, you know, we've gotten into this topic of this is all going to collapse under its own weight. Donald Trump is fighting multiple wars. You know, this is a man who has opened so many fronts, and obviously not just on the military side, right? Although I'm pretty sure I don't know if he's going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. I think it would be pretty apropos for what we know about that organization anyway. But he, as the thumbnail of this episode says, is pushing India and China closer together. Mm-hmm. Two states that up until a few years ago were on the verge of war are now being, well, like I said, pushed closer together. This week, the Chinese foreign minister, I believe he visited China. He visited India. He visited New Delhi, yes. And met with Modi. They hailed their the steady progress in their countries, blossoming relationship, and that they need to start working together as well. And just yesterday, the Indian foreign minister was in Moscow. He was meeting with Russian officials, and they also called for closer cooperation within the BRICS framework and to increase, I think, hold on, I have it here. Like also defense cooperation, but mainly economics, right? In particular, under the threats of Donald Trump, under the tariffs, which I believe they're still in place, right? The tariffs he imposed on India. what is the outcome? What is going to be the outcome of this? Do you think we're still in the first year of Trump's presidency? You know, I feel like many of us kind of forget that just because of the amount of ridiculous stuff that has happened. But we're still within the first year. What is the second year of the Trump presidency going to look like? Is Trump the catalyst for the multipolar world? Is he actually boosting up BRICS by taking these, you know, warmongering stance?
He's not. It's not the catalyst for the multipolar world by any stretch. I mean, the multipolar world started when there was, you know, it was obvious there was flagrant inefficiency and inequality and stagnation and economic decline in the West, where you know, countries that had been resource rich but poor before were now technologically advanced. They were sort of underwriting Western economies by providing the services to them, providing the resources to them, even providing the PhDs at MIT, at Harvard, et cetera, you know, the engineers, the scientists, et cetera, India, China, Vietnam, Iran. So that's what kicked off multipolarity, you know, an unsustainable kind of doomed decline on, you know,
the hegemon,
and then real growth, and not just growth, but also having at the same time a convergence of very, very unique leadership in several powerful countries that envisaged a more egalitarian world, okay, where development and economy were, and sustainability were the focus, and sort of rogue capitalism wasn't. Right. So I think Trump is just accelerating it. It was, in a sense, already accelerating with Biden's. Don't forget, you know, Gaza, whatever happened under Biden. Syria happened. Remember Syria, Libya, et cetera, happened under Obama. These are like
the OPEC oil cuts as well under Biden, like Saudi Arabia taking revenge on Biden.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, Trump is just an accelerator in some aspects. I mean, I don't know why he came, how he came up with the tariff things. I think there were other ways to get better trade terms with countries that you trade with, rather than just literally telling the whole world you're going to slap tariffs on them, you know. And then instead of negotiating with the whole world, he just said, I don't care about all those countries. We'll just do about like 6 or 7 of them, right? It's kind of crazy. The rest of them have to just suck it up. And by the way, tariffs are just inflationary for Americans, not for anyone else. Completely. You know, so this trigger is very interesting because, you know, he went after India purchasing Russian oil and gas, okay? And the thing is, the India-U.S. relationship has been much ballyhooed for a number of years, you know, from sort of Obama onwards, because they wanted to extract India from the BRICS like they wanted to extract Brazil from the BRICS, right? And they kind of largely did with those two countries. But India has a historic non-aligned constitutional, you know, position, and he's triggered that in a like-minded, you know, semi-fascistic leader like Modi, who, like Trump, doesn't like Muslims and kind of has a superiority complex, etc., for his country's nationalities, his religion, his sect. And so they tried to pluck India out, and India started feeling like it's a valued rising global power recognized by the Americans, etc., and then just shut them down in the same way they did like Trinidad and Tobago, or just like rando country, you know, by saying we're gonna slap tariffs on you. At the same time, India is very, very aware that tariff negotiations are going on with the Chinese as well, and in fact Trump lowered those for the Chinese. But India's a, you know, a top-notch America, right, supporter. Why would they lower this for their enemy? So, of course, Trump triggered their non-alignment, you know, roots. And honestly, Modi you know, it's kind of like if you have a Likud leader like Rabin or Shamir or Begin, people like those who strike peace, it's a more solid peace, right? So in fact, Modi is the kind of sort of right-wing leader who, if he struck peace with China, it would stick, as opposed to if you had like a Congress party politician do it, right? So he's shifted them off. And now here what they did when the Chinese foreign minister visited New Delhi was they just kind of broke through all of the layers of difficulty in their relationship, you know, instituting like a visa, you know, allowing each other to visit each other's countries, relaxing trade restrictions, easing the movement of citizens, allowing pilgrims from India to visit holy sites in Tibet, you know, a major sort of thorn in the sides of their relations. And even I think there's talk, I mean, it was talk in the Indian media that China would, you know, China had like stopped the trade of rare earth minerals and, you know, high value resources, and that may be released to India. Now, China-India's relationship is, they have a strong trade relationship that's gone on despite border disputes and flare-ups, okay? This is where the Americans have benefited absolutely. They, first of all, they very much, the Indian elite media, like Western media, like Persian Gulf media, is very sort of like pro-US. So you have that kind of neoliberal thinking dominating the press there. And so every time there's like some kind of clash on a border, and there are many borders between India and China that were never settled. So anytime there's a clash, of course, the media makes the biggest thing out of it and makes it almost impossible for any Indian head of state or, you know, top diplomat to make any headway and to calm things down. But this is Modi himself, you know, I mean, whatever they've done now, and it was a breakthrough. It was a significant breakthrough because in their most sort of heated arena, which is on those borders, they decided to sort of like, instead of waiting for a final hashed out agreement, they decided to solve a lot of little small problems immediately, boom, boom, boom. Okay, like a testing ground almost. And that will continue. And then Modi will be going at the end of this month for the SCO meeting, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in China. And I think that gives some time in which to come up with, you know, a larger agreement, because there he'll be meeting with Xi Jinping, his counterpart. And I think, I mean, for sure, the Russians will really want that relationship to be on track. The Iranians will want that relationship to be on track. The thing is, there are only, is it nine? Nine members of the SCO, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, just roll back a bit. The border disputes that the Americans would always like, you know, hype up. What China's reaction to that was to get closer to Pakistan, an Indian adversary, right? And of course, Pakistan and China's relationship have come, you know, very far along, as we saw in the last military skirmish between India and Pakistan. And so India really, really was shocked at the outcome of that and the global perception of it falling militarily, right? Yes. It took a real beating. And so this is an opportunity to make good with China. China, India, Russia, Iran, Pakistan, you know, to grow, you have to calm your, right? You have to have peace. You have to have security. And all these countries are hyper-focused on development and economic growth. They don't want conflict. And actually, just those few SCO members, and don't forget, the others are by and large Central Asian countries where America is coming in, as we saw with Azerbaijan, Armenia, etc. They want peace of Kazakhstan. They want, I mean, like oil resources, whatever. Uzbekistan, important, you know, etc. So these SCO countries have the ability at this meeting to really make some shifts. And of course, what's key is having members like India, who is a founding member of BRICS, and obviously one of the elite SCO members, but has always been an outlier, you know, doesn't really go along with the multipolar agenda of the if these organizations' other members. But if India falls into this, you know, and says, let's give this one a try now, a lot could change. You know, India is very defensive also of Iran, of Iran's position and of Armenia's position in the region. It's slightly hostile to Turkey. That helps bolster Russia's position. India and Russia are quite close. Russia's increasingly close to China, that strategic partnership, and of course, Iran. And that, you know, with the Indian-Chinese rapprochement, India won't mind all of this so much. I just think we have the makings of something really substantial. If there's a breakthrough between, you know, New Delhi and Beijing, the world could turn on this quite significantly.
Indeed. I think it's very interesting what you just said, Charmin, a few minutes ago about how India is witnessing the U.S. Dealing with the enemy, right? Having negotiations still with the enemy while imposing tariffs on allies. Yesterday, I saw this poll on the published by Bloomberg that said 80% of Canadians do not believe that Donald Trump's going to stick by any trade deal, that he's going to violate it. You know, Canada, historically, the United States, well, second to Israel, closest ally, right? Even just by proximity. And the people here are saying, like, there's no way we can trust this government. We see what they are doing. Karim, I want to ask you a couple of things. One, I think we should find a way to moderate the comments because there's a full-on war going on. That we have a couple of trolls, which I would take to our, I would tell our audience, let them comment. We welcome the engagement. But in any case, at some point, maybe we should look into that in how to maybe block some of these people. And also, I don't know if you want to read, we had a couple of super chats from Lav66 and asking a couple of questions.
Yes. Let me check down.
Does Beirut feel reasonably safe right now? You know, it does. That's the thing. If there's any lull in violence, even for 24 hours, the Lebanese go about their business. They really do. They go to the marketplace as though nothing. But I will say that there's a lot of conversation about war restarting. And the thing is, right, we get asked these questions a lot. Is war going to start? As though we know. The thing is, people do anticipate an Israeli-Iran war. But the reason they worry in Lebanon is because they know that Lebanon has now become a punching bag for Israel, in the way it did, Gaza has been for many, many years, and indeed the way Syria has become. And so if the Israelis can't get off, you know, get out their frustrations because they can't attack Iran, like I said, they're kinetic. They need to keep bombing. So there is concern about that, and what would be a trigger for something so pointless? It would be, you know, the resistance not disarming potentially. But I don't know. I don't know. I think the resistance has stepped up recently quite a bit in Lebanon, said, okay, enough with this shit. Okay, we've let you guys talk shit. You cannot defend the South. You cannot get rid of the occupation. You can't defend against it. You're allowing our soldiers to be killed. Okay, you haven't made any zero headway with the Americans and French, your counterparts in like sort of the negotiations committee or whatever, the ceasefire committee. And in fact, the enemy is getting bolder and continues to strike. So, I feel like the resistance has kind of said, all right, enough already. Though today, we were talking about this earlier, and I did see somebody in the chat asked this question, what has happened with the disarming of the Palestinian camps? Because something did happen today. You want to talk about that, Karim?
Yeah, so today in the media, they said that Palestinians, especially in Brajni camp, they wanted to hand over their weapons. And many people like cheat for that, especially people that are against Hezbollah, because since the beginning of Hezbollah, and when Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was the secretary, he always said that the Palestinian camps are red lines because, of course, they are against the Israelis. And, of course, they had they experienced many massacres during the Lebanese civil war. So many people were shocked, including me. I thought, you know, if they handed their weapons, many bad things can happen. Yani, two armed men can enter the camp and kill like hundreds of people. That's what used to happen in the Lebanese civil war. But apparently what happened is that there were illegal weapons that they were smuggled inside the camp. I don't know, maybe by some Syrians, because also we saw many Syrians crossing the border from Syria to Lebanon, mm-hmm. and they went mm-hmm. public and they had like TikToks and everything, and the Lebanese government did nothing. So apparently the head of security of the camp said that there were illegal weapons that were captured by the security of the camp in the past 48 hours, and now they will hand them to the Lebanese government. And he said that we and the Lebanese government and everybody, we are one, we live in the same land, and all of these sort of things. But he said, he didn't say it directly, but he indicated that their weapons will not be handed over because they are not illegal, while illegal weapons in the camp will be handed over to the Lebanese government. And when the anchor asked him, will you hand over your weapon for one of the fighters? He said, of course not. And he moved away. And they showed some display of power, because during this interview inside the camp, there were like 20 or 30 people holding weapons shown in the video. And they all shook their heads that they will not hand over their weapons.
But also today, hand over their weapons the Lebanese camp. Military handed over an Israeli prisoner too. I just want to mention that very quickly.
So the
nothing apparently.
Noaf Salam, who's going to get tough on the Israelis if they violate the ceasefire anymore, which means maybe he'll only do a quarter bow compared to a full-on half bow. essentially is like, let us show you goodwill. The Lebanese are very, very good businessmen, right? They're all around the world. They're probably per capita among the most millionaires and billionaires of any country in the world. And they're in every corner of the world because of civil wars, occupations, et cetera, right? So like Latin America, Africa, Europe, North America, Asia. And, if they become political, they don't seem to be able to negotiate. I mean, how can you be this bad at negotiating? Literally, you give over someone, nothing in return. Here, we're giving you one of yours. How is that?
A gesture of goodwill, I'm sure.
No. Noaf Salam, you were a judge, okay? You're not a negotiator. Joseph Fallon, you're a military commander. Okay, get a Lebanese businessman in there to negotiate. You have zero sense. Who does that? Who gives an occupying enemy that has violated ceasefire terms over and over and over again? Who gives them something more? Are you stupid?
Yes. You know, Sharmeen, I have a new conspiracy theory that Noaf Salam felt so bad when he was in the ICJ because he had to like prosecute the Israelis. He felt so bad, and he demanded to be like
to be removed
out of the situation. So they put him prime minister of Lebanon. This is my conspiracy theory.
He was inserted as prime minister of Lebanon, obviously by the Americans and like absolute idiots, people who are against resistance, people who are against independence.
Right? They saw him, how sad he is.
just very briefly, everyone in the chat, we have over 300 people listening to us right now. Thank you so much for being here. Make sure to leave your like. That helps a lot, so that this video gets suggested, so that our channel continues to grow and we can continue to make more content for you guys, for everyone else who's out there. But
thank you, Kimberly Jones, for $4.99. Much appreciated.
Much appreciated, indeed. Hezbollah has, like you said, Sharmeen, taken a very firm stance now, right? What they are saying is we're not gonna give up our weapons. And even like we talked about the poll, I think last week, right, about like most Lebanese opposing it without a defense strategy. Lebanon seems to always be in this cycle, right, of like war and stability, some form of stability. Like right now, we saw, I saw a few numbers a few weeks ago that said that this year, Lebanon had the most tourists arriving since 2019, since the economic collapse of 2019. That is insane. And that speaks to the Lebanese people, whom I love very dearly. And, you know, I admire very much. Like, they just go to their country no matter what. But are we headed to civil war? And I know, Karim, in particular, you are, you believe that there's no way out of that one.
Yeah, well, I used to say that even before everything that happened, because the way that the people that are against Hezbollah or that they align themselves with Israel, they are acting in a way that tells us there might be a civil war. And the civil war in Lebanon was triggered by the same people that are now in power, and that they control the media and many social media platforms and many even singers and actors. So this might happen because, for instance, yesterday we often talk about the Lebanese forces. It's not the Lebanese forces, it's a party called Lebanese forces. For instance, their speaker yesterday, Sharmeen, went to TV and said, I demand Shias to be out of the army. Oof. He said that. He said, we don't want Shias to the army. They can go to Iran and let us have the army. For instance, that's the way that they talk. They say, and even yesterday on a very important TV channel in Lebanon, they had like a historian interview that was aligned also with the Lebanese forces, who said that we are not Lebanese, we are not Arabs, we are Phoenicians. And he explained why. He said some Phoenicians became Arab, some Phoenicians became Christians, and some Phoenicians now prefer Iran, so let them go to Iran. So they are canceling a big portion of the they are even dehumanizing the Shias in Lebanon, not only the Shias, even the Christians that are against Israel, they dehumanize them. So we know, as Israel did, they started to dehumanize Palestinians so they can kill them every now and then. These people are doing the same. They are saying stuff that I can't even say on YouTube because we will be like somehow
banned
or something. So that's what's happening in Lebanon. And also here, what's happening is that these people, when they talk like this, or if they made like any movements on the street, the army and the judges in Lebanon, they do nothing. While, for instance, anything that is being said or acted by the other party, which is like Hezbollah and their friends, they are being prosecuted and they are taken to the court. And for instance, even 2 days ago in the parliament, they want to prosecute Naim Qasim, who's currently the head of Hezbollah, because of his hate speech. What are you talking about? This is so crazy. This stuff triggers me. And this is very dangerous to trigger me because I'm a very calm person. Other Shias or other people that are aligned with Hezbollah, for instance, they will be triggered 10 times more than me. And this is the dangerous thing. And this is the thing that leads to a civil war. A small fight on the streets, a small incident on the streets or in a dangerous place that is like, for instance, if a Christian died in a Shia area or Sunni died on a Druze area, there might be a civil war.
Remember the Tayune incident of 2021?
Yeah, during the Tayune incident, there was Sayyid Hassan. Yeah, Sayyid Hassan, if they say to his people, sit down, they will sit. Act, they'll act. Don't act, they don't act. We don't know till now the power of Naim Qasim on his people or his decisions. And I hope we don't want to know, because we live in very dangerous times. I don't want Lebanon to happen what happened in Suwaida. Maybe you'll see people from the Lebanese forces attacking people from Hezbollah and drones from Israel paving the way for them. So it's very dangerous.
Indeed. I want to thank very quickly Bisser for their $4.99 super chat. They say Lebanese state leadership running one last camp before they run off to Paris or Dubai. Yeah, kind of. Hey, what were you going to say, Sharmeen?
I mean, Karim's right. These guys are playing with fire, and they've become emboldened because the resistance has kept quiet. This is 100%. The thing. They're stupid. they don't understand a quiet resistance means a resistance that has taken a strategic decision to leave the occupation for the time being in the hands of the new government and give the new government a chance to shine. Not only has the new government not grabbed that opportunity and run with it, they really, really sold out Lebanon. And so the occupation, for the time being, in the hands of the new government and give the new government a chance to shine. Not only has the new government not grabbed that opportunity and run with it, they really, really sold out Lebanon. And so, you know, in this vacuum, in this silence of the resistance, the other side has sort of become emboldened, almost like they'd had, you know, like they were careful, then they had one whiskey and they started to talk a little bit more. And then, you know, at 11 p.m., they'd had four whiskeys and they were suddenly super mad. I'm going to personally take out the whatever. You know, this is kind of the immaturity of the political discourse taking place by those opposed to the resistance. They're getting very nasty, very sectarian. You know, they're against who they view as their opponents in this country. They're asking people who are anti-American or anti-Israel, are you Lebanese? Like, are you Lebanese? What makes you Lebanese? What makes you Lebanese? Because you kissed the boot of the American ambassador. That's what makes them Lebanese. That's not what Lebanon is, okay? Lebanon existed way before the United States. No, 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 honey, right? But these people are drunk. They're drunk on the fact that nobody stopped them from talking. Nobody's like interrupted their conversation and they've just gone wild with it. But in my view, at some point, someone's going to come out and smack them hard. You remember, like, no, so like 2008, they just pushed it. They just pushed it so far after, to their horror, the resistance beat back the enemy in 2006, right? And they had like a absolute like government of beasts at the time, right? Pro-Israel, pro-America, taking orders from the unipolar world. And so they became like more and more bolshy. And then they went right for the jugular of the resistance. And the resistance came, slapped them around for 3 days in Beirut, right? Guarded the homes of their senior officials so nobody would try to do a false flag, right? And then left. And these guys shut their mouths for a really long time. Anyways, these guys are sort of like punch drunk right now, and they're saying ludicrous things, and something's going to kick off, and you know, some asses will be kicked, but a civil war could also happen. And so these very people who claim the resistance is triggering like all kinds of calamities in Lebanon are actually the ones who could trigger the biggest calamity yet, you know, because nothing worse than a civil war.
Indeed, indeed. 100% agree with you there. Do you guys think, because it's inevitable that Israel is going to attack Iran. This is like, you know, to me, it's just the writing is on the wall. They're both rushing. I don't know if you discussed this on the episodes we missed, Sharmeen, but about how China is apparently, like the Israelis are super concerned about how China is apparently helping Iran rearm itself in self-defense, in particular for the air defenses. I mean, its air defenses, and maybe even providing it some missile batteries as well. Israel, in the same race, the Pentagon is asking for $3.5 billion from Congress to refill what was used during the 12-day war and also during the war with Yemen, etc. We saw Larijani, the advisor to Ali Khamenei, going to Lebanon, Iraq. I don't know if he went anywhere else. And do we feel, my question here is this, with the being it inevitable that Israel is going to restart this war, Is the war going to take a different shape? And by that, I mean, are we going to see the Axis of Resistance act together? Because Yemen has been still launching attacks against Israel and has proven to not be deterred by the attacks that Israel has launched in Yemen. They haven't done anything to degrade their capabilities. Mm-hmm. As well, as you said, Sharmeen, they're kind of just sitting and waiting, saying we're not going to give up our arms. And Iran is on a race to rearm itself. And the Iraqi militias, I think they are just, you know, kind of still figuring out exactly what they're going to do. What do you guys think is going to happen when Israel decides the time is prime for a war again?
I prefer that Iran is the one to start, not Israel. This is number one. And number two, yeah, of course, Israel will be afraid from China's technology, because it's the only technology available now in the world that can counter Western technology, NATO technology, and the United States technology. Because, of course, the Russian technology is widely exposed due to the war in Ukraine. And, of course, the Iranian technology, I think it was weak during the 12-year war. The missiles were very successful, but I think the Iranians countering cyber attacks and finding spies on the ground was very slow during that 12 days war. I think China and the technology that China has can possess a big threat to the Israelis and to the West, because first nobody knows what China has. Yani, China.
I mean,
so
we saw
close.
It with Pakistan, right?
What, yeah, we saw it with Pakistan. It was only like 3-4 hour dogfight. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It was very short, and I remember when they said that they hit three airplanes. I thought it's all about propaganda. No, you can't do that within like 2-3 hours. But apparently they did. So I think, of course, Israel should be afraid of that. And I think I don't think the Israelis can do what they did at the beginning, because they had the time to infiltrate the Iranians to build factories, mini factories for drones, and all of this thing. I think now it's very difficult to for them to do it. And of course, they need more time, because the Iranians now, their eyes are open, and they already caught many of the spies.
They said more than 20,000, right, that they caught.
Yeah.
So I think the number 20,000 is people that were detained and interviewed or interrogated, but I think they've charged a much smaller number of that, or no, a much smaller number than that. Like hundreds have now been convicted, not 20,000. So I think the 20,000 number was to indicate that they had really done a sweep, you know? So yeah, I don't, we did talk about this while you guys were gone. Obviously y'all did not watch the podcast while y'all were lazing on beaches or whatever.
We've been caught, Karim. We've been caught.
So the it's really hard to say what Karim is saying is wishful thinking. We did talk about how it would be, you know, Iran can use the example from the George W. Bush years, you know, the Bush doctrine of preemptive strike against a potential one day strike from an adversary state, right? Iran, the Americans have laid the groundwork. The Israelis have laid the groundwork, right? They can just say, no, we have knowledge that the Israelis were ramping up to strike against us on such and such date, so we launched a preemptive strike. I've never seen that from the Iranians. So, but again, the thing I love about the Axis and I hate about the Axis, that you have no idea what's coming out of there. But then when the surprises are good, they're good, you know. No, we don't know. We simply don't know. We can just sit here and blah, blah, blah on a podcast.
Forever.
Yeah. But a preemptive strike would be smart, because the Axis has always said they will strike at the time, right? The time and conditions of their choice. But in fact, it's very likely, in my view, that Israel will choose the time and conditions that favor it. And they can only just then be prepared and do a counterstrike immediately that Israel won't be prepared for. Not the immediateness of it, but the nature of it, you know? So yeah, it could work many different ways, but I wouldn't, I mean, the Israelis could be finished within 48 hours of attacking Iran for reasons we've talked about before. Don't look at me like that, Karim. We're just talking, Israel's a small sliver of a country with no geographic depth. You just have to hit a few desalination plants, three gas platforms, one electrical grid, a few, that's it, right?
I mean, you know,
I think 48 hours is too much. That's why I gave you the slogan.
Well, because the Iranians are Persians. They're very soft.
They love...
Six hours is enough.
Their lovers, not fighters.
You know, the aim of the... first of all, I want to clarify something. What nonsense tells me that the Pentagon request does not include the refill request for the 12-day war. So what the Pentagon is asking, that probably just has to do with the war in Yemen. And in any case, what I wanted to say is that... I completely lost my train of thought. I completely lost it.
It's okay. We actually had lulls in conversation while you guys were away. Nobody knew, or should we let the other one speak or whatever? And we were like, wow, that was like 10 seconds.
I remember that the aim of the 12-day war was to dismantle Iran, to turn Iran into Syria, right? Like, this is what they wanted. This is why they activated all of the sleeper cells and the factories that Karim was talking about. And they didn't work. It didn't work because the Iranians, even if they hate, you know, Ali Khamenei and they hate Pezeshkian, they were all like, no way we're going to let our country become, you know, a next Syria or a next Iraq. They rallied behind the government. We saw, remember the images of the Iranians on the street as the missiles were flying above their heads with the air defenses and everything.
And they
else.
Were so mad when Iran stopped.
Yes. And now
they were like, why did we stop?
Now look at Israel. Look at what's happening in Israeli society. Can this society withstand another, you know, sustained attack from Iran? Like, this is gonna, you know, it's gonna tear at the seams of what of this, you know, genocidal entity that is already at each other's throats.
Oh my God, Esteban, you sound like me. What happened? That vacation was super good, I guess.
I guess it was.
Doesn't he's like, they're coming to an end. It's happening. The frog is boiled.
I don't know. I mean, it's you have to consider that, right? You have to consider exactly what is happening within the entity. Within the entity, they are really, you know, up to their necks at this point. But in any case, I feel like they're going to continue with their push to ethnically cleanse Gaza. I don't see any way of stopping that. They're going to try to ignite something in Lebanon before launching the war with Iran to kind of, you know, cover their six in a way. They've been talking about restarting the war on Yemen. So... like, how and is this going to end?
Our prediction, and Karim was on the last episode on Monday, our prediction was right, that even though Hamas, at the moment that we were giving the podcast, we got news that Hamas had agreed to the bridging Egyptian agreement for, you know, an agreement with Israel. We said, no way, Netanyahu will just move the goalposts as he did today. All right, because he doesn't want a ceasefire. He wants the occupation of Gaza. They're going full force. Really, I mean, the world can stand in front of them now. I think we're coming to, you know, one of those trigger points. This could, what they do with this massive onslaught, this, you know, assault of Gaza right now, could definitively change the way the international community treats Israel. So
the upcoming siege of Gaza City is going to prove to be as disastrous as I feel like we have been predicting, because there's no way that this army is going to be capable. Look at what happened in Khan Yunis yesterday. In any case, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to mention, just before the podcast started, Hebrew media reported that the Israelis ordered refueling aircraft. They ordered two and they are on the way, and they also ordered four that are under construction from the United States, which indicate that they want to use them for long-range operations.
Will they get there in 2035? They always make these things again, know, kinetic, narrative, just momentum. I saw that news item too, but there was no deadline date. And there are a lot of back orders in the U.S. military industrial complex.
Indeed, a lot of work for the arms companies, a lot of work for Boeing still. With that, I think we can wrap this week's episode. We can wrap up this week's episode. I want to thank everyone who joined us today. Make sure to leave a like before you leave. Make sure to subscribe to our channel, to check out our memberships, and to check out our Patreon as well. Like I said, this is where you can become a direct supporter and help the cradle continue
Please.
To grow. And make sure to check out William Van Wagenen's book, Creative Chaos, Inside the CIA's Covert War to Topple the Syrian Government. Very interesting read. Make sure to get it. Again, thank you so much, and we will see you on Monday.
Bye-bye.